I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She's the author of a number of books, or co-author of a number of books about the English language, and also a regular contributor to our show. And when she's here, we invite your calls, 212-433-9692. Or you can write us on our show page, or you can write us on Facebook or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And, of course, people write to you all the time, Pat.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You have your own blog, and you also take questions on the language. And often that inspires what we talk about on the show.
Yes, it does sometimes. Actually, something that your previous guest said reminded me of a question, and maybe you know the answer to this. Why does he refer to Piero della Francesca as Piero? Why do we call great artists by their first names, Leonardo, Michelangelo, Donatello? Why don't we, well, we don't say Ludwig for Beethoven or Wolfgang for Mozart. Why is that? Do you
well,
know?
Why do we call her Cher? Madonna. I don't know. Piero is just, but in the case of
we say great artists.
Well, we say Giotto, and we usually use one name, Masaccio, Mantegna. When we come to the Bellinis, we have a problem because there's a whole family of them. So then we have to distinguish between Giovanni and the others.
But, well, anyway, I was just curious about that while he was
speaking.
Yeah,
we do say Titian, Caravaggio.
That's true. It's not universally true, but
I don't know.
People even say call Van Gogh Vincent. Sometime.
Vincent, yeah.
Vincent, of course.
Well, with that in mind.
Yes, with that in mind.
I know you brought in some stuff, but I want to ask you something that I've been meaning to ask you about for a while now. The word podium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I understand it, the podium is what you stand on, and then there's a lectern in front of you.
Right, but that you read from.
But I have been hearing more and more, he stood behind the podium.
Yeah.
And to me, that immediately describes somebody standing behind the stage and being obscured by the stage.
Right.
But I think it's pretty much
crossed over.
It's becoming the standard.
These things happen. And we have to learn to roll with the punches if it really bothers us.
That one, I don't know why that one bothers me.
Maybe because it's got the word for foot in it.
Yeah.
And you don't stand with your foot in front of your face when you speak to people.
I mean, it's nice to say he stood at the podium or on the podium.
Right.
But I want to give some credit to that lectern. Okay, anyway, enough of that.
Okay, I wanted to add a small footnote to the recent election of the new pope. As we all know, when a new pope is elected, the news is announced in a white stream of smoke released from a special flue in the roof of the Sistine Chapel. And this rather dramatic ceremony with black smoke rising each time the cardinals fail to reach a decision, followed eventually by the long-awaited white smoke, it has a feeling of great antiquity about it, as if it were a very ancient church custom. In fact, it isn't. It was only initiated in 1914, not quite a century ago. In fact, the Vatican is a real latecomer to this tradition of sending messages with smoke. And we can't call it language exactly, but I guess I can justify bringing it up because it is a form of communication.
Do we know where they got it from?
Well, it was the idea of a pope in person who was pope in 1903. I think it was a Benedict. If I'm wrong, I'll hear about this. But there had always been some confusion about when a pope was elected. And it turned out, that the cardinals always burned their ballots at the end of each voting. So it was decided, why not make the smoke a form of communication, I suppose. And there have been times in the past when it was difficult to tell whether the smoke was white or black, or it might start black and turn white, or vice versa. So they've had to fine-tune it over the years with the additives, the chemical additives.
Because you have to find ways to make sure that it comes out white.
Exactly, yeah, so that there are no, you know, people don't have conniptions there in the square. But the Vatican was, as I say, it was borrowing on a very old tradition, because for thousands of years people have used smoke signals or fire beacons, usually smoke signals by day or fire beacons by night, to communicate simple prearranged messages about something like, say, the sighting of enemy forces or news of a victory or the like. Nearly 2,000 years ago, there were signal towers used on Hadrian's Wall, the Roman in Roman occupied Britain, and some historians believe that there were signal towers spread throughout ancient Britain even before the Roman occupation. And then, of course, there were signal towers erected along the Great Wall of China for sending messages by smoke or by fire beacon at night. And even in 16th century England, fire beacons and puffs of smoke were used to send news about the advance of the Spanish Armada in the English Channel. So this has been around for a long time. And, of course, it's a notorious cliche by now, and a little bit exaggerated, that Native Americans used smoke signals as well. They used puffs of smoke released from fire in much the same way the Europeans had used them, the Chinese, South American Native tribes, and Australian Aborigines.
But we have, in the case of Native Americans, we have used that symbol as a way of suggesting that they were primitive people.
Exactly.
Whereas we have not said that the Romans were primitive people and
course,
that anybody in the Vatican is a primitive person.
Of course. And not only has that tradition been greatly exaggerated in the case of Native Americans, but and the significance of it overvalued, but they were not actually communicating with words per se. I mean, it's not as if they were sitting around texting one another for entertainment. As with all smoke signals historically, words weren't spelled out in semaphore fashion, and the information sent was not complicated or intricate. There were no minutiae of enemy troop movements and all that kind of thing.
300 people coming from the northwest
right,
on horses.
Right, with three cannon. Yeah, exactly. The messages were very simple, merely announcements of one kind or another that were prearranged in advance. Perhaps water had been found, a food source. Maybe it was a simple affirmative or negative that had been arranged in advance. But
let me alert our listeners to the mm-hmm. fact that my guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We're talking about the language, and we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or on our Facebook, or Twitter us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org, and we'll be getting to the calls in just a few moments, mm-hmm. but please proceed.
Well, I wanted to mention the fact that fur traders and explorers often recorded in their diaries when they saw Indian smoke signals, and these were generally, in all likelihood, simple warnings that strangers were in the neighborhood. Now, sometimes the prairie itself would be set on fire to warn of an enemy's approach, or in some cases, just to call widely scattered tribes together for a conclave of some kind. And the white frontiersmen themselves used smoke signals for their own purposes. It's known that the Fremont expedition in 1845 into the California deserts, the guide Kit Carson went ahead of the expedition in advance of the main party, and he had arranged to send smoke signals if he found water. So the Vatican's beginning to use smoke a century ago as a means of communication was just part of a long and sometimes misunderstood tradition.
Okay, well, should we take some calls?
Yes.
In fact, we have a caller who wants to address something we discussed a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, you're on the air. Is Michael from Manhattan?
That's me. Hi, Leonard. Hi, Patricia.
Hi.
I'm no scholar on the subject, but I had always thought that we refer to, for instance, Leonardo as Leonardo and not as Da Vinci, because it means simply Leonardo from the town of Vinci. So that really wouldn't be his name.
Oh.
Maybe somebody out there could correct me, but that's what I always thought.
And Piero della Francesca means Piero of the Francescas, I guess. Or
uh-huh.
The but, of course, that would be a last name.
Yeah. And the D part would be merely the honorific or the
mm-hmm.
I can't. There's a name for that, and I can't remember it right now.
But that's probably true in the case of Michelangelo. That doesn't work. His name is Michelangelo Buonarroti.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Buonarroti is too long. It's hard enough to.
I don't know. I don't know because composers of the period weren't known by their first names. That's what I've always just wondered, if there was something special about artists that.
There's always something special about artists.
Oh, of course.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. Maybe somebody else even has more details, but I suspect it's just it's made life easier instead of having to say Michelangelo de I think his name was Michelangelo de Caravaggio. Just say Caravaggio, Vermeer.
Uh-huh, right.
Okay, well, our next caller is John from Paramus. Hi, John, you're on the air.
How you doing? Patricia, you're my second favorite guest. My first guest is now Bob Knight, and if anybody listened last week, they'll know what I mean.
Oh, okay.
I have two,
Bob Knight is the basketball coach.
He plays as Jerry Lewis, by the way. I have two quick phrases I'd like to know, since it's getting close to Easter. On the lamb, even though I know it's not lamb,
no.
And high on the hog. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Okay,
you.
I think on the lamb refers, the lamb is a reference to... it's spelled L-A-M, not L-A-M-B. And I think it has to do with the leg. I've actually answered this one on my blog, but my memory is so terrible that I can never remember what I know.
Well, I looked it up in the dictionary.
Which means I don't know it anymore.
And I looked it up in the dictionary.
Uh-huh.
And according to American Heritage, origin unknown. So
maybe
you don't know it because nobody knows
it. Well, maybe that's it. And I know that high on the hog... refers to eating the best part of the pig, although I don't really know why the...
Especially since bacon is from back
bacon
in the
is
end.
The underneath
and
part.
As far as
part.
I'm concerned,
that's
it's one
the
of
best.
The basic food ingredients.
I know, one of the four major food groups.
Okay, well, thank you for your call.
I actually have a recipe for caramelized bacon. You cook it in sugar.
Mm. That's what we need, salt and sugar.
Right.
Jack from the East Village, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've always wondered if there's a foolproof way of distinguishing whether or not to use that or which.
Yeah, it's pretty foolproof, although not everyone these days would argue that it's necessary. But the foolproof way is that if you can dispense with the information without hurting the sentence, it should begin with which, and the whole clause could be thrown out.
Such as?
Such as, this shirt, which I bought at JCPenney, looks like it came from Armani.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you could not dispense with the information, you would start it with that, and that means that it's necessary to the sentence. The shirt that I bought at Penny's looks like it came from Armani. It tells you precisely the shirt that you're talking about. So if the information is dispensable, it could be introduced with which, and if it's essential, it could be introduced with that.
Now... in my experience, spell check is always changing which to that and that to which.
I wouldn't trust it. I think you should make those judgments for yourself. My experience has been that grammar checking programs are far from perfect.
Carol from South Salem has written to our show page asking about how people started using more importantly and whether it's mm-hmm. incorrect.
It's not incorrect. I used to, I've actually changed my position on this. 10 or 15 years ago, when I wrote my first book, I felt that more important could be used to introduce a sentence because it doesn't refer to, it can refer to the whole sentence, and it's not an adverb. What I'm saying is about to be more important. In other words, you're using it as an adjective. More importantly is that's an adverb. You're using it as a sentence adverb as you would hopefully. Well, I've
Which people didn't want to
Yeah,
use
I've
either.
Sort of changed my mind about hopefully too. I don't see why you can't use it to introduce a whole sentence rather than to modify a particular word in the sentence.
Well, can we extend that a bit further? What about firstly, secondly, thirdly?
I don't find anything wrong with those. It's awkward. I think it would be best to just say first, second, third, rather than firstly, because how do you do something firstly in a first manner? It doesn't sound like an adverb to me.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, You Send Me, Words Fail Me, Origins of the Specious, Woe Is I Junior. Have I left anything out?
I don't know. I don't think so.
We'll be back with more of your calls and what you've written to our show page at WNYC.org after this.
Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days, and what I feel in my heart.
And you can ask your question in more than three little words. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And lots of people have been calling in about smoke signals. Here's Stephen from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to add a comment to the ancient use of smoke signals of fire. In about 2,000 years ago, before the Jewish calendar was completely set, each month was determined by the new moon. That could be either 29 or 30 days long. So in order to let people know in outlying areas when the new month had begun, especially with Passover coming up soon, especially near holidays, the Talmud lets us know that fires were lit on mountains, and that was a way to communicate as quickly as possible that the new month had begun, and a way of setting the calendar, actually, through the use of fire.
Thank you so much for calling us and telling us that. But we're not doing that anymore, are we?
No. Actually, that even in ancient times, there was a little political infighting, and the Samaritans would light fires at the wrong time in order to confuse things, and so eventually send out messengers because that was more efficient, although less quick, way of getting the message across.
So the Samaritans weren't always so good.
I was just thinking that.
Thank you.
You know, the word calendar for our calendar comes from the word calends, which was the name of the first day of any month in the Roman calendar was called the calends. There was no singular. That was just the form of the word, calends. There were three marker days, the calends, the nones, and the ides.
Mm-hmm. We know about the ides.
Yes.
Bill from, where are you? Wheatley Heights. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
You want to tell us more about smoke?
Not exactly. It's the opening day of the Erie Canal, 1825. There was set up a series of signal cannons, and it was called the Marriage of the Waters or the Wedding of the Waters to connect Lake Erie with the Atlantic Ocean. And so when it was opened, the first cannon was fired, and when the next cannon attendant along the river, along the Erie Canal, saw the smoke or heard the shot, I guess he saw the smoke first, he fired. And the sequence went on all the way to the Atlantic Ocean in New York City, and it took 81 minutes. and that was the fastest communication on record at that time.
So that just means where there's smoke, there's been cannon fired.
Yes. So the
I almost screwed that joke up.
The person could see it, I'm sure, long before he could hear the report of the cannon. Mm-hmm. And so it was a way of communicating, but it also marked the opening day of the Erie Canal in 1825.
Oh. Thank you for sharing that.
That is interesting.
We learn on the show.
I know. On the Great Wall, which I think is 750 miles long, the Great Wall of China, the signal towers could send a message from one end to the other. And they did it in that same way. When one signal tower saw the smoke, it would keep going. And it was, not a bad way to send a message hundreds of miles.
Sandra from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a former advertising copywriter, and so I found it very disturbing when I saw and heard a spokeswoman for a denture cleanser say that her product was different to toothpaste. Oh. I mean, I would never mess around with prepositions as a copywriter.
Different to toothpaste. Mm. It's not only awkward and stops you a bit, but the bad alliteration of two toothpaste, I can't believe that a copywriter actually wrote it that way.
But Winston Tastes Good as a Cigarette Should was written by a copywriter. We've had a lot of ungrammatical
he wrote
copy
like
over
there. Like a cigarette should.
Oh, like a cigarette yes. should. Oh, I correct. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, but I think that was
in
done.
Fact, like has become the word for the comfort word for so many people. I just think that a whole generation is speaking in similes.
But, that was a good move on Winston's part, that choice,
yes.
because it got people's attention. And, they followed up with, after all the criticism, they followed up with, what do you want, good grammar or good taste?
So, Sandra, do you think your copy chief would have caught that?
Oh, absolutely. I would have caught it. I never, never, never would have done that. It's very jarring.
Yeah, that does sound strange. I'm not sure it helps sell toothpaste either.
No.
Thank you for calling us. Jenny from Levittown. Hi.
Hi. First time I finally got on the air. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, I knew you'd been frustrated in the past, so I wanted to take care of you.
You're psychic, too. Good. I did have a question, and I don't know why the English language thrills me so much because I'm in the science field, but that's okay. We all need it. I wondered about, actually, two things, because while I was on hold, I thought of something else. But people, do they misuse the words plethora when they say, I think correctly, it's a plethora of whatever. But then I see a lot of myriad of. Is that incorrect?
Myriad of is not considered incorrect anymore.
This is another
thing that I've switched myself.
Third one is multiple,
on.
Isn't it?
Multiples?
Yeah.
Well, how would you misuse that?
Well, I didn't say
you'd
you
say
misuse, but
multiples
I mean, all
of.
Three, yeah, they say.
Yeah, multiples.
There were multiple
of.
Examples of.
Yeah, but myriad can be used three different ways. You can say, there were myriad opportunities. He had a myriad of opportunities. Mm. Or there were myriads of opportunities. Mm. It's now acceptable to use that in any of those ways. We shouldn't feel compelled to use words as the Greeks or the Romans used them.
Well, you say that, but then when you write that in the New York Times, there's a slew of letters complaining that you are being
a plethora of.
A plethora, myriads of letters that are complaining that you are being much too permissive.
I know.
The next thing you know, the world will fall apart.
I wasn't always like this. I used to be a real stickler, but the more you look into language, the less black and white these things become.
Like commas.
Yes.
Can I ask my other question?
Sure.
When did Carnegie become Carnegie?
When he named himself Andrew Carnegie. That was his name.
Well, it was Carnegie originally,
yes.
Wasn't it? That's the Scottish pronunciation. And in Philadelphia, is it? Or at Pittsburgh? I guess Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's the Carnegie Institute.
They will insist on Carnegie. Here we say Carnegie. You don't say it. You say Carnegie.
I do. Well, Carnegie Hall.
You say schism, too.
I say schism.
You say schism. I'm sorry.
And I'm wondering about all of the to-do over the word virtually and the way the vice president uses it almost in every sentence.
He uses it in every
sentence. Well, he uses it a lot. It's virtually this, it's virtually that.
Oh, well, it's a little tic of his, I guess.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are using the word virtually these days.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it – that's kind of like in the past where you would say it's actually, really, really – or yeah, what
yeah,
is that actually?
Actually, it's actually this way. But you know, we have to – you know, these things will go away eventually if we ignore them.
Patricia, hi. You're on the air. Patricia of New Jersey.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for taking my call. For over 70 years, the use of the word either has confused me.
Either.
As young children, our teacher told my sister and me to put an ashtray at the on either end of the table. Mm-hmm. Long tables they had at school waiting for something. One of us put two, and one of us put one. Now, which one would be correct? Is either, I understand now, it would mean both ends of the table.
No, I think one end or the other.
Otherwise, you'd be both ends of the table.
Yeah, right.
Yes, but often, even reading, one sees on either end, and it means two.
It means on each end.
Yes.
Right. I haven't had this question come up before.
Neither have I.
I haven't either. But I would just betcha that both usages are accepted.
What about the pronunciation? Either, either, neither, neither.
They're both correct.
Okay.
I know that for sure.
And sometimes... I've heard people use both of them
in the
same paragraph.
Yeah.
John from Morristown. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks, guys. Fascinating review on the smoke signals, historical analysis. And so another historical point for humankind as well as local. I'm just an amateur historian. Someone may correct me, but I believe that General Washington spent much of his time out here in Morristown with his troops and at his own headquarters. And so there was a smoke signal system whereby if the British troops in Manhattan were on the move, our side in Elizabeth would send up a signal that would be picked up in the Watchung Mountains out at Springfield, New Jersey, which in turn would then be picked up at the top of a little hill called Fort Nonsense in Morristown, so that Washington would get the smoke alert, the fire alert, that troops are on the move.
Well, I know that both sides used smoke signals during the French and Indian Wars. So I'm not really surprised to hear that. But how did people in Elizabeth know that troops were on the move in Manhattan? I mean, if they saw them coming out of Manhattan toward New Jersey?
Well, ultimately, there was one particular winter, one of the fascinating facets of the war and local history, the lore is that one of the winters was so cold.
Oh, that Hudson froze.
By 6 feet or so, they say. And so that would be one way if the troops were to actually go by foot. But, of course, the most daunting element of the troops was the British ships themselves. So this is where I'm an amateur historian. I'm out of my realm. Regardless, mm-hmm. I would presume that they would be able to pick it up, through spies perhaps, on the island side,
right.
Though also possibly simply ship movements one way or the other.
Well, thank you so much for your call. We're learning so much
today. Yeah, that's interesting.
And we go now to Jack from, where are you from, Jack? Oh, West Caldwell, New Jersey. Hi, Jack.
Yes, hi, how are you? I was I heard your discussion about different from and different to, and there's also different than.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a alt.usage.english news group on the internet that addresses this in their FAQ. And different to is, it's not the prominent British form, but it's much more prevalent in British than in U.S.
That's true,
usage. It's about 27% of the cases in the UK and less than 1% in U.S. U.S. Uses different than at 30%, much more than U.K., but different from is the most common on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. That's sure. True. You will find different, too, if you do a lot of reading of old British novels and such.
We don't have the time to go to any more calls. We've run out of time, but a number of people asked about ending sentences in prepositions. How far do you go?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's a myth of grammar. Nothing wrong
and
with it.
And splitting the infinitive really has to do with Latin. It has nothing to do with English.
There's nothing wrong with that either.
To ask Pat a question, you can email her directly at mailbox@grammophobia.com. You can also click on Pat's blog at grammophobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WMYC listeners. And please write to her. Don't write to me, because I'm just going to have to forward it to her. Anyway, again, mailbox@grammophobia.com. You can also read any of Pat's many books, Woe Is I, Words You Send Me, Words Fail Me, and The Origins of the Specious. Pat, we will see you again on May 15th. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. See you then.